From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Law enforcement officers train to maintain control. Why is it so hard to pivot to de-escalation?
Human beings are, we're flawed. Human beings make error. What we try to do in everything that we do, in every profession, we're trying to mitigate risk.
Today, one Michigan sheriff talks with us about changing old traditions. Also, a teacher's union weighs in on reopening school this fall.
90% of our educators say that until we can return to quote-unquote normal, standardized testing should be postponed, eliminated.
And a health director for West Michigan's Kent County talks about mitigating summer risk.
These tools are not perfect, but testing in partnership with isolation and quarantine and using PPE and health screenings, all imperfect tools, but taken together, they can be effective in battling COVID-19.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the Michigan State Senate unanimously passed reforms for police training. Later this hour, we'll speak with one sheriff about what his department has learned about its own biases.
And I could have the best policies and training and evaluation in place, but if the culture of the organization doesn't value life, doesn't understand the service aspect of what we do, then we're not going to be successful.
And he says even the best training won't end violent interactions completely. Stay with us. That's coming up later in the hour. But first up, what's happening in preparation for fall? You don't have to be a parent to have a stake in how public schools will handle classes later this year. Your workplace will very likely be affected by it. It might make a difference in whether or not your essential service workers can show up on the job. School districts have been working hard on planning. And the Michigan Education Association, representing 120,000 teachers, has also been thinking about it. The union just released a member survey on COVID-19 challenges. Paula Herbart is president of the MEA, and she's also part of Governor Whitmer's task force advising schools, the Return to Learning Advisory Council. Paula Herbart, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
You were just appointed, as we mentioned, to the Governor's Advisory Council for Return to Learning. Can you tell us about the mandate and how fast you're going to have to do this work?
Well, the mandate comes from the governor in trying to find a way to return to learning in the physical buildings. We've been still teaching and educating children throughout COVID-19 through distance learning and remote learning at home. But we know that there is likely going to be some want to go back into school buildings and have classrooms meet face-to-face. And the governor's return to school task force will be charged with figuring out a way to do that if it's possible to do it in the fall.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the MEA's survey results. You received more than 15,000 responses from members. What kind of health and safety concerns were teachers talking about in their results and specific things that they would feel better about schools doing to keep everyone healthy?
Well, one of the things that they're saying is they want to make sure that there's set and enforceable safeguards for public schools, that whatever the task force comes up with, that they're certain that they can be assured that they can be met by every school district. 75% of our members talk about taking temperatures of students and staff entering buildings and carefully tracking illnesses, that would be essential if we were to return to school buildings. 74% of those surveyed said they believe schools should provide and require usage of masks and other personal protective equipment for employees. 68% believe that would be necessary for students.
Mm-hmm. When we think about how social distancing is going to work in the classroom, this is not exactly rocket science, but it does sound like it could be very hard to enforce, especially when we're talking about elementary grades. What does the survey show you about teachers' confidence that they'll be able to do it effectively?
Well, you know, one of the things that they talk about is their need to have smaller class sizes in order to prepare for strong social distancing measures. 90% of our educators say that until we can return to quote-unquote normal, standardized testing should be postponed, eliminated. And, you know, one of the things that we're talking about is the amount of uncertainty that will happen when we go back into school buildings to assure the safety of our students and our educators, and then their families, meaning students' families as well as educators' families. And I'm talking about educators throughout public school, not just classroom teachers, certificated individuals, but our paraeducators, food service, bus drivers, et cetera.
What's your impression about how teachers are doing with knowing how to perform online teaching? We know that some districts are talking about a blend of online and in-person teaching in the fall. Do you feel like teachers have the prep time they need to deliver online?
Well, I think that one of the things our survey has said is that educators believe that they, the vast majority of them, say that they're working harder than they've ever worked and longer hours than they've ever worked when they've taught face-to-face, doing distance learning. And part of that is because they're learning how to be good educators in the distance learning model. And so we need to make sure that we support educators in the classroom with strong professional development on what it means to distance learn and using devices or other methods to educate children in a distance learning environment, and that we provide the mentors. So someone that is a strong distance learner, maybe has done it for 6 to 7 years blended while we've been meeting face to face in a traditional classroom, that those experts in the field are helping support all across the state educators who haven't had the same amount of experience nor the same amount of expertise in providing that kind of support and teaching environment for students.
What's your sense of how many districts are offering professional support for teachers as they move into more online instruction?
Well, I would say, I mean, this is anecdotal and I don't have a firm number on this, but 100% of the school districts are doing everything that they can to support educators who are providing distance learning. The struggle comes in when you may not have broadband or one-on-one personal devices for students because of maybe access to internet, maybe access to one-on-one devices, all of those sorts of things. And then how can we fund that? It isn't that school districts don't want to provide those supports for educators. They absolutely do. But until we have broadband access across the state for every student, every school district, until we provide funding to ensure that one-on-one devices not only are in the hands of educators and students, but are able to be accessed through that broadband service, we can't expect school districts to provide it if they don't have the funding to do it.
What did teachers have to say in the survey about concerns for their own personal health or maybe their older colleagues?
Well, you know, one of the things that they say is that we could possibly be looking at thousands of new educators coming into the profession, because 32% of our educators say that they're thinking of leaving public school education or retiring early.
Wait a minute. So thinking about it, that this is a combination of several different responses, including, yes, I'm leaving the profession. Yes, I'm considering leaving. Yes, I'm retiring earlier than planned. Yes, I'm considering retiring earlier than planned.
Correct. So it's a combination, but regardless of the reason, if we're facing a possible 32% decrease in those who are currently working within public schools, that's huge on top of an already strained system and pipeline of potential educators.
I mean, are we looking at even more long-term substitutes in the classroom at that point?
Well, I don't know exactly what the solution will be. One of the things that MEA has been advocating for is perhaps having internships and apprenticeships with student teachers coming into the classroom as a possible solution. That has not been asserted or approved in any way, similar to a residency with a physician.
Sure.
Or student nurses.
Right.
With patients. And so, and then having them locally bargain small stipends in order to make sure that they were paid for their expertise and helping us through this crisis. I think that that's something that could be looked at with the governor's return to school task force, particularly if we are in fact facing significant numbers of people leaving the profession.
Paula, there's one more thing I wanted to ask you about, and that's summer school. In some sense, broaching the question with Michigan schools is like asking the person whose house is burning if they're having that 4th of July party that was planned earlier. What did teachers say in the survey about whether summer school should be offered?
You know, one of the things that teachers say is that they definitely want to help support those students who have missed the gaps. But if we're going to do summer learning, it needs to be remote. It can't be face-to-face. And if we're going to do summer learning, there has to be, again, locally bargained contracts, which will adequately pay these educators for giving up their time to prepare for the fall to help these students transition into the summer. We have to understand that we have always provided summer school throughout school districts to help those students who have not met benchmarks that we've hoped that they would meet during the regular school year. And school systems are continuing to provide those programs. But if you're talking about a statewide plan to come back to school early to address some of those needs, that would have to be dealt with at the local level. And educators are overwhelmed right now, and they are telling us that. And that's something that we heard in the survey. They're working harder and longer than ever, and they need time to reflect on what went well. They need time to reflect on how they can improve their practice, and they need time to refresh from what has been, for all of us across this state, a very stressful time. And so they have suffered that no less than anyone else, and I would say they've suffered the kinds of stresses similar to those frontline essential workers that have been working day in and day out in hospitals and in care facilities. Our educators have been part of those essential workers, and they need a time to refresh, recoup, and regain their sense of stability to prepare for what we know will be an even more difficult time in reentering the workplace for students and educators.
Paula Herbart is president of the Michigan Education Association. Paula, thanks for being here.
Thank you, April.
Elsewhere in the news, West Michigan's getting ready for summer.
Here in Kent County, we didn't have that huge surge of cases in the early days, and so we have kind of seen a slower burn of the epidemic here.
Health Director Adam London is going to talk with us about trying to keep that burn set to low. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As people make their way back out in public, maybe even head back to work, county health departments will be on the front line of preventing a second surge of infections. So how exactly do they prepare to do that, and what's it going to mean for the spread of the virus in their communities? Dr. Adam London is director of the Kent County Health Department, and he joins us now. Dr. London, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thank you. Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
When we talk about lifting the stay-at-home orders and reopening certain sectors of the economy, such as bars and restaurants, is the county ready for that?
Well, I think that we are ready for it. However, I think that we're also in a very vulnerable position. You know, we have seen that the numbers decline steadily over the past month. We saw what we believe to have been our peak in late April, early May, at least here in Kent County. But we recognize that we're in a vulnerable position now, and we're not going to get to a risk-free, virus-free environment for a long time, if ever. And so we need the participation and the collaboration of employers, of the community, in order to make sure that we keep this as under control as we can, especially for the next year until we have a vaccine available.
Right. Even as Southeast Michigan's seeing its curve start to flatten, we know that West Michigan's is still on the rise. And now Kent County's case numbers are beginning to trend downward. Do you feel like the community has made it through the initial surge?
I do. And when we look at the epidemiological curve for this, we actually saw the highest rate of daily cases between about April 29th and May 2nd. Also, our positivity rate, the percentage of our tests that are coming up positive. So that's all trending in a great direction. We have had a more aggressive testing strategy here in Kent County that I think other areas of the state have employed. And so we've sent strike teams of employees from the health department to some of those higher risk vulnerable settings, places like long-term care homes, shelters for those experiencing homelessness, our juvenile detention, our jail, places like that, to make sure that we're looking for the virus and not just waiting for people to show up, sick people to show up at the hospital.
What are those teams doing?
They're actually testing. So, for example, we went to two of our largest homeless shelters here in Grand Rapids, and we tested their entire guest population, which was almost 270 people, regardless of whether or not they were symptomatic or not. And what we found in that first run of tests was a positivity rate of about 27%. We then isolated those individuals who were positive, and we made sure that we had a separate facility for them where they could recover in dignity and remaining in isolation from the rest of the population, which was negative. And then we retested a couple weeks later. And when we retested the population, those who were previously negative and new guests, we found that the rate of positivity had dropped to 7%. We then isolated that group, and we tested the remaining population a couple weeks later. It had gone down to 3%. And last week, it was down below 2%. These tools are not perfect, but testing in partnership with isolation and quarantine and using PPE and health screenings, all imperfect tools, but taken together, they can be effective in battling COVID-19.
You've talked in recent weeks about the increased spread of infections in Kent County's Latino community, in part because many people in that community serve in essential industries. We know that COVID-19 has also hit African-American communities in the state hard. Do you anticipate that reopening could heighten the disparity in infection rates that's already a problem?
Yeah, it's a concern that we have. And we're seeing about 39% of our positive cases identify as Hispanic, and about 19 or 20% identify as African-American or Black. And those rates are significantly higher than their prevalence of the overall population. And so, you know, we know that those groups consisted of a large portion of our, quote, essential workforce over the past few months, working in food service and other service industries critical for society. We also know that they suffer from adverse health effects because of disparities in health equity and social injustice at a higher rate than the rest of the community, and often have underlying health conditions because of that at a higher rate. So they're vulnerable. There's also language barriers, a number of challenges that we have. Now, we have been very active in trying to address those issues. In fact, we've opened more testing sites in communities that have very high percentages of Hispanic and African-American populations. We're also doing much more with translation and with working with employers to make sure that they have the information that they need to protect their employees as best as possible. But it's going to be a battle. And one thing I think is very important is that we all realize that we're not going to beat this pandemic unless we all beat it together. And as long as we have high rates of infection in any part of our community, our entire community remains vulnerable, because this will spill from one group to another so long as those disparities remain.
Aside from what you've already mentioned, what kinds of questions are you getting from the business community right now as they get ready to get their operations back on track?
Oh, lots of questions. So we're getting questions about interpreting the executive orders. We're getting questions about masks and PPE. And so
are people are people able to get what they need?
In many cases, the answer is yes. But in some cases, especially with smaller businesses, they really struggle. They don't have the same HR and purchasing infrastructure that large businesses have. We have created a KentCountyBackToWork.com website that has our guidance. It also has links to how people can get PPE from Kent County if they're a small business located in Kent County, along with thermometers for their employee health screenings and an employee health screening tool. So we're very thankful that we've been able to get this resource to them before they reopen. There's a lot they can do. You know, there's a lot that they can do to make their place of work as low risk as possible for their employees and their customers. One thing we're very careful, though, is we want to make sure that everyone understands that we're not going to get to a totally safe environment where, you know, safe to me implies absence of risk. And there is going to be some risk. We need to focus on mitigating that risk and making it a low risk place of work and place of business.
Public health workers like yours have always done contact tracing. Usually, though, it's been something like measles or STDs. The novel coronavirus requires this on a scale that's really not very much like anything that we've seen before. How have you been preparing for that?
Yeah, so, you know, thankfully, we have lots of experience in doing contact tracing and case investigation because of all those other infectious diseases that are reportable that we work with on an ongoing basis. This has been to a level, an order of magnitude far greater than what we have previous experience with. So we have trained other staff in our department, which was kind of the easy first thing to do because we had so many other service areas that had paused, whether it was our vaccination program or our well and septic program, health education programs were all, you know, paused for a while. And so we trained those staff to fill the gap.
So for starters, you're just getting more people involved. Yeah,
exactly. More people, volunteers. We brought in temporaries from the outside as well. So that's been a huge help to us. The challenge now is that those other programs are going to reopen here very soon. Our vaccination program, we've got to get that going. That's very important to us. All of our other programs are critical as well. So we're going to lose our own staff to their normally regularly assigned lines of work. And so we're working right now to bring in more temporary employees from the outside.
We have a little less than a minute left. Can you give us a sense of what you're keeping an eye out for in terms of warning signs that maybe things aren't going according to plan with the reopen?
Sure. So, you know, I have a lot of skepticism with the case numbers because we all know there's far more cases than what have been tested. I think the best measure is hospital inpatient rates. And we work closely with the hospitals to keep an eye on that. Because that, you know, severity of symptoms and what gets people hospitalized doesn't really change very much. So we're watching that along with our death numbers. And that's the most tragic outcome of this, but also it's an outcome that is hard to dispute, even though some have tried quite a bit recently. And as we see our death numbers stabilize and fall, and as we see our hospital inpatient numbers remain solid, and they have, our hospitals are in great condition right now, and they've all been very vocal about that. Those are things that we're going to watch very carefully. A resurgence in inpatient rates or a resurgence in death numbers would be very concerning to us.
Dr. London, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, April. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Adam London is director of Kent County's Public Health Department. Hundreds of angry people with no leader and no plan, a city and a police department on edge. That was Grand Rapids again last night, less than a week after protests downtown turned to property damage and looting. But last night, things turned out differently. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer reports.
Things were quieting down. The official event, the one that was planned, ended at 5:30. Organizers asked people to leave downtown, and people didn't listen. Hundreds remained. They didn't want to leave. So they started marching. They made their way to a barricaded street. Green dump trucks lined up, blocking off a section of downtown, the section where the police department headquarters is. The protesters took a knee. Then, a man stood up. He had a tattered American flag wrapped around his torso.
We are here right now because we mean business! We are here right now because we are unhappy! We are here right now because we are all God's creation! Yeah!
Suddenly, this man they've never met, this man talking about God, he has their attention. He delivers a rousing speech, making it up as he goes. And his name, he tells me, is Brian Jennings. He's from Chicago, only been in Michigan a year and a half, only been in Grand Rapids 2 weeks. And when his impromptu speech ends, people stand up. What's next, one of them says. They start marching again. Jennings jumps on his bike, makes his way to the front. They take the street, the man with the American flag leading them on his bicycle. And they make up the route as they go along, up to Heritage Hill, over to Michigan, avoid the highway because police have it blocked off. They march for a mile, then two. Others decide to take a role in this new community. Hannah Schaefer hands out snacks and water.
I, I really didn't expect any of this, and I was thinking, what can I do? These people need fuel. This is a peaceful protest, and this is what we need, so we're going to keep it going.
And at the back of the march, a white car appears, driving slowly, pulling into the opposite lane to block traffic and protect marchers. A man leans out the window. He tells me he goes by AG, just AG.
Didn't nobody ask us to do nothing. We took it upon ourselves because this is what we believe in. For real, this is what we believe in. It's too many murders from the police with black people.
The march stays on residential streets. I catch up with Jennings, who's still leading the way.
Did you know any of these people before today?
Excuse me?
Did you know any of these people before
today? No, I did not.
I ask him who decides where they go next. He says, God's in charge. But 4 miles into the march, something happens. Police, who at first followed the protest on bicycles, have now melted away, and the march has made its way into new territory. They march into East Grand Rapids, a separate town, a wealthy enclave known for leafy streets and lakeside mansions. Some people come out on front lawns to wave and cheer, but one woman walks into the middle of the street holding a baseball bat, ready to swing. Jennings grabs the bat. The crowd tries to take it away from her. Justin Tavernier's in the middle of it.
We protected her. We removed the bat. Grabbed it. We walked her to the sidewalk away from where people, because people were starting to get aggressive. We don't want that. We want a peaceful protest.
I ask if she said anything to him.
She told me, you don't live here. I don't know what that means, because I do live here. But she said, you don't live here.
Born here.
The march continues. And occasionally Jennings stops them to gather. The people kneel in the street. He talks about justice and God and Jesus. He asks for a moment of silence, then he leads them in prayer.
Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done.
After they've said two Our Fathers in the street, they get back up to march. They're headed back to where they started, downtown where the streets are barricaded and police wait in riot gear. The people have been walking for more than 7 miles. But downtown, the mood shifts. The marchers step up to the barricaded line of law enforcement. I'm standing between the line of protesters and the deputies in the riot gear. I can't see everything that's happening, but everyone feels the tension rising. And the protesters come up with a simple ask. They want the sheriff's deputies to kneel with them. The deputies stare forward, unflinching. Earlier in the day, the chief of Grand Rapids Police had come out briefly to talk to the protesters at the original event, and he took a knee. But that didn't seem to satisfy this crowd, and the people with the riot gear and shields never kneeled. Minutes tick by. The law enforcement in riot gear, they're not city police, they're county sheriff's deputies. After several minutes, the deputies with their black armor and their faraway stares, they change. They meet the protesters eye to eye.
One knee will live. One knee. One person kneels, we live. One person kneels, we live.
One deputy looks at the guy next to him. Do you think he's telling the truth, he asks. The other deputy nods. But they do not kneel. Jennings has given up talking.
We don't got to talk to them no more. We right here. We right here and they right here. We going to see who leads first. We don't got to talk to them no more. They know what we want. You can
sit down. He turns his back to the line of deputies. But this is not the only line. On the other side of a dump truck, more deputies are stationed, filling the gap between trucks. And other protesters have been pleading with them, too. Suddenly, past Jennings, a cheer goes up. The deputies in their riot gear, at least one of them, has taken a knee. The deputies taking a knee, it was a symbolic gesture, one that the city's police chief had already done earlier in the day. But one protester, Anthony Jacobs, tells me this gesture meant a lot to him.
You know, we're out here for a reason, and they know we're out here for a reason. Just show that you're not one of the bad cops that we're out here protesting against. Like, we know all cops are not bad, but right now it looks like all cops are bad because no one is standing with us, and that's literally all we want.
Let's go home! Let's go home, guys!
And that's it. After 3 hours and almost 8 miles of improbable, unplanned marching, the people disperse. No tear gas, no rubber bullets, no violence. After grabbing the attention all night, I find Jennings alone, leaning up against a bus stop. He's weeping. I ask what's going through his mind.
Oh, man. I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm just happy. Dude, I'm just happy. It's a miracle. Yeah, we all know where miracles come from.
I think Jennings knows, like everyone else, that a few deputies taking a knee doesn't solve the big structural problems that led to the march here or anywhere else. It won't bring back George Floyd. It won't bring back Breonna Taylor or any of the other black lives lost. It won't undo any of the painful incidents of police using force against black people in this community. But on this night, for one night, at least for the people here, it feels like a change. I'm Dustin Dwyer, Michigan Radio News.
In a moment, Sheriff Jerry Clayton of Washtenaw County shares what he told state senators looking for advice on police training reform.
All force is an attempt to control, but all control tactics aren't force. So my presence, how I talk to you, all those are opportunities for me to get compliance and to take care of a lawful objective.
That's after the break. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan's state Senate passed a bill requiring all law enforcement officers to take training in conflict de-escalation and recognizing bias. The vote to pass this bill was 38-0. Can we just take a moment with that? It has been so rare for all of Michigan's elected leaders to agree on anything. The bill in question was proposed by Ann Arbor area Senator Jeff Irwin, and it actually predated the death of George Floyd, but there is no question the debate was informed by protests against police use of force in several Michigan cities. Jerry Clayton is the sheriff of Washtenaw County. We've spoken to him in the past about training methods to reduce violence. We thought it was a good time to reopen that conversation. Sheriff Clayton, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
First off, one of the incidents that captured public attention so completely last month was a video of one of your deputies punching Shatina L. Grady, who was refusing to leave the scene of a shooting in Apple Ridge, Ypsilanti Township. Your office is investigating the use of force, and I'm guessing you can't comment on an active investigation, but can you tell us anything about what needs to happen in that investigation or your timeline?
Sure. So I can tell you what we've done to this point. So within 12 hours of viewing the video and finding out about the incident, we put the deputy sheriff off on administrative leave. And within 24 hours, we had reached out to the Michigan Sheriff's Association, which provides investigators from various sheriff's offices. So really securing an outside entity to do a criminal investigation of the allegations of excessive force. We have an internal person that does our internal investigations. So he started collecting all the information. So when the external investigators came, they would be prepared. And within 48 hours, I had spoken to our state attorney general, Dana Nessel, and she agreed that she would receive the criminal investigation package from the MSA investigators and make the final determination whether she's going to charge or not.
Looking at this more broadly, can you tell us a little bit about what informs the way law enforcement officials use force?
So although different states may have slightly different versions of subject control, the use of force continuum, they're all, you know, really grounded in a couple of Supreme Court decisions. And it's really around how law enforcement responds to the resistive behavior they get from subjects. So in our subject control use of force policy, which we last updated last year, we wanted to make a distinction between subject control and use of force, because all force is an attempt to control, but all control tactics aren't force. So my presence, how I talk to you, all those are opportunities for me to get compliance and to take care of a lawful objective. And then if I get resistive behavior, then I may have to increase my options to physical controls or using some kind of device like a taser. And the police officer is to take into account what we call the totality of the circumstances. So they have to process all this information while they're interacting with someone and trying to come up with the right kind of outcome. And the last thing, you know, we've added de-escalation. It is mandated de-escalation in our policy to attempt de-escalation as long as it is safe to do so.
Do you think you've learned anything about the fundamental tension between de-escalation and maintaining what deputies see as their need to maintain control at a scene?
You know, when I was going through the police academy, it was a different mindset. We were taught, get into the scene, establish control as quickly as you can, bring a conclusion to the scene, let's move on to the next thing. That's how we were trained. That was the orientation. The basic assumption was the quicker you got in, the quicker you could establish control, the safer everybody was going to be, and we could accomplish our lawful objective. Now what we are learning is, whoa, wait a minute. Speed does not equate to efficiency. Now, because we not only review the actions of the officer, the time they use force, we're looking at the actions that led up to potentially using force. And you build into your policy and you change from a cultural standpoint in the organization is that the value is not speed. The value is how do we interact with people, whoever it is, and they, all of us, come on the other side of that interaction physically, emotionally, and psychologically without harm. Now, we're not asking them to rush in. We're telling them, assess the situation from a distance. That distance and time is your friend. To be able to assess whether the person may have a mental health disorder or substance use disorder, they might be in crises. And if they are, they might not be able to understand your lawful directions. And also, is this situation beyond your capacity, beyond your ability to manage? And do you have a lifeline, say maybe a mental health crisis team that can come out and assist you in the process? So that's the pivot that I've seen more than anything else. And, you know, in the policies, it's the sanctity for all human life, not just the police officers, but all human life. And if you start from that perspective, then I think you're more likely to get a better outcome.
If the legislature were looking to you or other sheriffs or police chiefs in the conversations about reform and training that are going on right now, what would you tell them?
So I would tell them, this morning I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And part of what I say is, so we always recognize the importance of training, but we don't recognize the connection between training and the organizational and community outcomes that we want. That if we work with the community to establish the outcomes that we want, then we must be sure that we articulate to our staff how they can behave to help get to those outcomes. And then the training comes in play because now we know the knowledge and skills that they need to behave the way they need to behave to get the outcomes. Here's the hardest part. It's about culture. We can't just legislate our way to the kind of relationships that we want, the kind of society that we want. We have to look at the societal culture, the assumptions that we make about people. The organization has to look at its culture. And I could have the best policies and training and evaluation in place, but if the culture of the organization doesn't value life, doesn't understand the service aspect of what we do, then we're not going to be successful.
You know, to that end, there might be people hearing this right now who say, yes, I know that the office went through, you know, has gone through significant training on this, but there's still that video that surfaced last week.
Sure.
I mean, is this a situation where we are ever going to get there?
Yeah, and I would argue that in a lot of places, and our place included, that we're farther along than we were. I got this question in response to my testimony this morning, where it was like, well, look, sure, if we gave you all the money we could to do all the training and you could do all the recruiting and everything, can you guarantee me we'll never have an incident like George Floyd or anywhere else? And the response is no. And the reason is we hire human beings. Human beings we're flawed. Human beings make error. What we try to do in everything that we do, in every profession, we're trying to mitigate risk, right? I cannot guarantee, listen, we have spent 12 years in the sheriff's office working on our culture, our policies, our training, and everything. And I could never say to a resident of Washington County, you'll never have a bad experience with one of our deputies. I'm doing everything to ensure that you don't. And if you do, we'll hold that person accountable for what they did. But we have to have the right, we're trying to mitigate that risk. And the other piece I think is important is it's not just the internal, it's the external. How do we relate to the community? How do they understand who we are and what they do? Are we really co-producing public safety and building strong and sustainable communities in partnership with our community? I think all of that is important.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sheriff Jerry Clayton of Washtenaw County. There are protesters and activists, both in the streets and online, who advocate defunding the police, or in some cases, dismantling. They argue that law enforcement just takes up too much tax revenue at the expense of things like social workers, affordable housing, education, that would have a long-term impact on public safety. How do you respond to people who say we need to completely reimagine the role of law enforcement in our communities?
I agree. So I've sat on numerous panels, some with the Centers for American Progress, some with the Policing Project out of NYU Law School. We have just those conversations, you know, reimagining police. And I always challenge, let's reimagine society, because it's not just about the police. The police is just another example of the challenges we have from a societal standpoint. Public, you know, health. Food insecurity, housing insecurity, all of those things. So we do have to reimagine police within the framework of reimagining our societal construct. And if in reimagining the police and reimagining societal construct, we're looking at reallocation of dollars, so be it. But as we reimagine the societal construct, we must be very, very clear in terms of what our expectations are for the different units of government. So as you shift funding to other areas, understand you can't hold police to the same expectations that you did before in terms of responding to different situations. I hear all the time, well, the police shouldn't respond to a mental health crisis. You don't get many police professionals that disagree, but we are the ones that are 24/7, 365. So we would be happy to step back and let's have 24/7, 365 medical and mental health professionals that they can respond to some of those things. So I don't believe there's ever going to be an either or. I have acquaintances that are police abolitionists and they want to work towards that end. And what I say to them is that's fine. But until we do, we must find a way to work together, share the space and commit to change and create the kind of future that we want while you're working toward abolishing the police.
In addition to being a public official, you're also an elected official. And our police chiefs are appointed to their positions. Do you think that that accountability to voters makes a difference in operations?
Yeah, actually, I do. I talk about this a lot with a couple of folks. I think we directly report to the people. And I've said this in our county, if I'm going to tell you what we're going to do, try to share our values and outcomes and work with you. But at the end of the day, you have the power. And if you decide that you want someone else to be the sheriff because you think they articulate a different set of values and going to get you a better outcome, then you have every right to do so. Now, saying that, it's the political position, but it shouldn't be political in terms of decision making. So I understand the politics, but I make principle-based decisions. I already know some of the decisions that I make, people aren't going to agree with. I can't be such the politician that you can't make principle-based decisions because you're worried about getting unelected. From a chief's perspective, the chief can run the agency, but he or she is still impacted by the politics. And what I tell folks is a chief of police is far more impacted by the politics than I am. Far more. Because they have some discretion, but they still work for an elected body. And if you have a city manager form of government with council members that hire the city manager and hire the chief, and say you have 9 different council members, you may have 9 different perspectives of how police services are delivered or the role that they play. And now the chief has to navigate all those political perspectives to try to serve the community. As a sheriff, I don't have that issue. My job is to be open and engaged, listen to the people, and deliver the services that we said we're going to deliver. And if the in our community, I've been in office for 12 years, and one of our major police agencies have had five chiefs. So when you talk about continuity of leadership, it may be more stable in a elected capacity than in an appointed capacity.
You alluded to the fact that institutional structures struggle with racism and struggle with internal racism. How have your own experiences as a Black man informed the way that you run your office?
I think that might be one of the best questions I've had since, we've been in this particular space. So I talk about this. I live in both worlds, right? I am 55 years old and I've experienced this world as a 55 years as an African-American male. And that has shaped me tremendously. A grandfather, and I was born in Bessemer, Alabama. So a grandfather that was active in the civil rights movement and told me stories. My wife and I have three sons who have to navigate this world. And quite frankly, each conversation we had when they got a license was a scary conversation. They're grown men now, but it's still scary. So that perspective is what motivated me to work for almost 20 years on bias-based policing throughout the country. And when I was fortunate enough to be elected sheriff, that experience has really motivated me to try to create an organization where we're not perpetuating this cycle of discrimination that has existed for over 400 years. Now, it's also given me insight sitting in this police world, where now I can go back to some of my African-American friends and said, yeah, well, we had some stereotypes and unfair views of police officers, too. And let me talk to you about the objective of policing and the noble profession and the fact that we hire human beings. And the smaller percentage are the ones that are the problem. But I also talk about the institutional aspect of it. And we got to work to break the cycle.
I feel like I've been asking this question since Rodney King in Los Angeles in the 90s. And obviously it precedes that by decades and decades. But Sheriff, do you think America is approaching a different kind of tipping point in this conversation about use of force?
So people have said that the George Floyd incidents, the straw that broke the camel's back. This is it. But we talked about that with Laquan McDonald, right? We talked about that with Eric Garner. We talked about that with others, that this was the incident and that it's had a spark and, it wasn't sustained. I'm not sure if this is it. I mean, I don't know. I don't think anybody can say this is it. Nobody has that crystal ball. I do feel a different energy. I feel a different energy because, you see more law enforcement professionals stepping up and calling out the injustices that exist in our profession, where years ago we were too busy defending the status quo than to call out the fact that, all these people saying these things can't be wrong. Police officers marching with protesters, kneeling with protesters. There's a different spirit here, and maybe the image of one human being dressed in a uniform kneeling on the neck of another human being until his life expired is an image that's seared so firmly in our minds and our hearts that we can't stop until there's actual fundamental change. And I'm hopeful, but I'll say again, this is going to be extremely hard work that requires resilience and stamina and commitment for all parties involved. And I feel a pivot here in Washington County and elsewhere where we're moving away from blame, not away from holding accountable, but from blame to now starting to focus on where do we go to start this long process to developing the kind of world and the kind of country that we've always aspired to be.
Jerry Clayton is the sheriff of Washtenaw County. Sheriff, thank you very much for your time today and for all your work. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.